On the other hand, these ideas ran like wildfire through the military class, through Indian officialdom and the like. Hitherto, there had always been something apologetic about the army man in England. He was not native to that soil. Here was a movement that promised to make him as splendidly important as his Prussian brother in arms. And the imperialist idea also found support in the cheap popular press that was now coming into existence to cater for the new stratum of readers created by elementary education. This press wanted plain, bright, simple ideas adapted to the needs of readers who had scarcely begun to think. In spite of such support and its strong appeal to national vanity, British imperialism never saturated the mass of the British peoples. The English are not a mentally docile people, and the noisy and rather forced enthusiasm for imperialism and higher tariffs of the old Tory party, the army class, the country clergy, the music halls, the assimilated alien, the vulgar rich, and the new large employers inclined the commoner sort, and particularly organized labor, to a suspicious attitude. If the continually irritated saw of the Majuba defeat permitted the country to be rushed into the needless, toilsome, and costly conquest of the Boer republics in South Africa, the strain of that adventure produced a sufficient reaction towards decency and justice to reinstate the Liberal Party in power, and to undo the worst of that mischief by the creation of a South African confederation. Considerable advances continued to be made in popular education and in the recovery of public interests and the general wealth from the possession of the few. And in these years of the armed peace, the three British peoples came very near to a settlement on fairly just and reasonable lines of their long-standing misunderstanding with Ireland. The Great War, unluckily for them, overtook them in the very crisis of this effort. Like Japan, Ireland has figured but little in this outline of history, and for the same reason, because she's an extreme island country, receiving much but hitherto giving but little back into the general drama. Her population is a very mixed one, its basis and probably its main substance being of the dark Mediterranean strain, pre-Nordic and pre-Aryan, like the Basques and the people of Portugal and South Italy. Over this original basis there flowed, about the 6th century BC, we don't know to what degree of submergence, a wave of Celtic peoples in at least sufficient strength to establish a Celtic language, the Irish Gaelic. There were comings and goings, invasions and counter-invasions of this and that Celtic or Celticized people between Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England. The island was Christianized in the 5th century. Later on, the east coast was raided and settled by Northmen, but we don't know to what extent they altered the racial quality. The Norman English came in 1169, in the time of Henry II and onward. The Teutonic strain may be as strong or stronger than the Celtic in modern Ireland. Hitherto, Ireland had been a tribal and barbaric country with a few centres of security wherein the artistic tendencies of the more ancient race found scope in metalwork and the illumination of holy books. Now, in the 12th century, there was an imperfect conquest by the English crown and scattered settlements by Normans and English in various parts of the country. From the outset, profound temperamental differences between the Irish and English were manifest, differences exacerbated by a difference of language, and these became much more evident after the Protestant Reformation. The English became Protestant, the Irish, by a natural reaction, rallied about the persecuted Catholic Church. The English rule in Ireland had been, from the first, an intermittent civil war due to the class of languages and the different laws of land tenure and inheritance of the two peoples. the rebellions, massacres, and subjugations of the unhappy island during the reigns of Elizabeth and James I we can't tell of here. But under James came a new discord with the confiscation of large areas of Ulster and their settlement with Presbyterian Scotch colonists. They formed a Protestant community in necessary permanent conflict with the Catholic remainder of Ireland. In the political conflicts during the reign of Charles I and the Commonweal and of James II and William and Mary, the two sides in English affairs found sympathisers and allies in the Irish parties. There's a saying in Ireland that England's misfortune is Ireland's opportunity, and the English civil trouble that led to the execution of Strafford was the occasion also of a massacre of the English in Ireland in 1641. Later on, Cromwell was to avenge that massacre by giving no quarter to any men found under arms, a severity remembered by the Irish Catholics with extreme bitterness. Between 1689 and 1691, Ireland was again torn by civil war. James II sought the support of the Irish Catholics against William III, and his adherents were badly beaten at the battles of the Boyne in 1690 and Aughrim in 1691. There was a settlement, the Treaty of Limerick, a disputed settlement in which the English government promised much in the way of tolerance for Catholics and the like, and failed to keep its promises. Limerick is still a cardinal memory in the long story of Irish embitterment. Comparatively few English people have even heard of this Treaty of Limerick. In Ireland, it rankles to this day. The 18th century was a century of accumulating grievance. English commercial jealousy put heavy restraints upon Irish trade, and the development of a wool industry was destroyed in the south and west. The Ulster Protestants were treated little better than the Catholics in these matters, and they were the chief of the rebels. There was more agrarian revolt in the north than in the south in the 18th century. Let's state as clearly as our space permits the parallelisms and contrasts of the British and Irish situation at this time. There was a parliament in Ireland, but it was a Protestant parliament, even more limited and corrupt than the contemporary British parliament. There was a considerable civilization in and about Dublin, and much literary and scientific activity conducted in English and centering upon the Protestant University of Trinity College. This was the Ireland of Swift, Goldsmith, Burke, Berkeley, and Boyle. It was essentially a part of the English culture. It had nothing distinctively Irish about it. The Catholic religion and the Irish language were outcast and persecuted things in the darkness at this time. It was from this Ireland of the darkness that the recalcitrant Ireland of the 20th century arose. The Irish Parliament, its fine literature, its science, all its culture, gravitated naturally enough to London, because they were inseparably a part of that world. The more prosperous landlords went to England to live, and had their children educated there. This meant a steady drain of wealth from Ireland to England in the form of rent, spent or invested out of the country. The increasing facilities of communication steadily enhanced this tendency, depleted Dublin, and bled Ireland white. The Act of Union, January 1, 1801, was the natural coalescence of two entirely kindred systems of the Anglo-Irish Parliament and the British Parliament, both oligarchic, both politically corrupt in the same fashion. There was a vigorous opposition to the Union on the part not so much of the outer Irish as of Protestants settled in Ireland, and a futile insurrection under Robert Emmet in 1803. Dublin, which had been a fine Anglo-Irish city in the middle 18th century, was gradually deserted by its intellectual and political life and invaded by the outer Irish of Ireland. Its fashionable life became more and more official, centering upon the Lord Lieutenant in Dublin Castle. Its intellectual life flickered and for a time nearly died.